The a welcome sign to a little town. To say that here is where I got the figure. It says 187,000 people of Czech heritage live in my part of Texas, and something like 12,000 still speak some Czech. So you should all come visit. Stay at my house. Come visit. You know, they do all their traditional dancing. They do baking. It's very funny. So, I mean, very amusing. Indeed, if you care, as I said, at the two main areas, I'm part Moravian. There's quite up to one-third of all of America was settled by people of German or German or sort of a Czech area heritage, and about one-third is British, and one-third is kind of all the rest mixed up. But Czech people came to the U.S. kind of the two biggest waves I know about, and the first one is the one I'm related to. Back in about 1740 to 1760, quite a number of Moravians came to the East Coast, and they settled from sort of Pennsylvania down the mountains of Virginia. And so that's the group I'm related to, and my husband from Virginia is also related to. So a lot of Moravians came down then. And then in the 1840s and 1850s, all the Czechs who came to Texas came, my guess is they'd have to go all the way to like Hamburg and the ports in the north of Germany. And they would come, and they didn't land at Ellis Island, where had the stereotype of immigrants coming to America. They would have come down around into the Gulf of Mexico and either landed in New Orleans or here in the port of Houston. Houston, Texas used to be a very large port. So they said 187,000 all settled in that central area. So my own heritage is, well, the other part of me is I'm about half sort of German, Moravian mix, and the other half is Norwegian. It's an odd mix. When my Norwegian half, because everybody in America, you know, that comes from someplace else, and my Norwegian relatives, my great-grandfather, came to the U.S. to work on the railroad. He worked for the New York Central Line. And I love this. When he retired, he said, to hell with America, and he went back to Norway for retirement. So I never actually knew him. He had a son and who had a family here in New York. But as I said, when he got done, he said, forget America, and he went back home. Hi again. So, all right. I'll need my good old map here for a little while. Now for a little while, I've been talking about various kinds of sources that I've been able to use to try and tell these histories of kind of difference. So, if my whole goal in my research is trying to say, instead of just sort of one blanket American movie audience, where everybody sees all the same things and understands films all in the same way, which, is that what I should think should be happening today? And I've been talking about a number of different kinds of sources I've been using to try and tell these more individual stories, to tell stories of difference, and as I said, individuals and community and variety. Another one of the most interesting sources that I got my hands on is something that looks quite boring from the beginning. It actually comes from a trade journal. So all those by 1915, there were 20,000 movie theaters spread across the country. 20,000. Now, a lot of them were very small in these very small towns, but there were quite a number of them. And they found it was useful, even though they were all individually owned, as the industry came together with structure, they found that it was useful to start talking, to professionalize, and start having forums to talk to each other, as well as to share information. So, again, led by the studios out here in Los Angeles, a number of trade papers and newspapers for movie theater managers were formed. Most of them were either sponsored by or are under the very powerful thumb of the Hollywood studios. So these trade papers almost never, when they report stories about things going on in the industry, they don't say anything negative about, no bad news in them at all, especially from that of the studios and the bosses, which makes them kind of frustrating sources for us as historians to try, and if we're telling the story, how do we ever find what's going on? How do we ever find out what were conflicts and what was negative? So, but nevertheless, in reading these trade papers that are meant to service and are meant to talk to movie theater managers all across the country, I did find, even in that source, some small places where I could hear about regional differences, I could see conflicts, I could see individual managers trying to get their voices heard and to discuss issues. Now, even as I said, in the trade papers, it was kind of hard to hear about that. Because, as I said, managed or controlled as they were by the studios wanted to only put out the story that all our movies are wonderful. All our movies are hits. Everything is great. Here is how you should sell our movies. Everything is wonderful. So, as I said, that's the story the studios wanted to put out. And mostly they wanted to tell the stories to their own theaters, and they wanted to feature those big picture palaces. So in this trade journal, they mostly wanted everybody to follow the model of what their own picture palaces were doing. They said, put on advertising campaigns like ours. Show the same films. You know, assume they wanted to assume that the whole nation would be kind of one, all alike, and all following the lead of these palaces, of these biggest picture theaters that they owned themselves. Nevertheless, there were all these other little theaters who said, okay, we'd like to shoot for that as a goal, but we're frustrated. We have different needs. We have different audiences. We need something different from what you want to give us. Nevertheless, the studios, they said over and over again, the studios mostly just wanted to talk about this kind of film exhibition and this kind of audience. And they said, the rest of you all can just figure it out on yourselves. But as they said, I was interested in the perspective of the people in these little bitty theaters. Okay, so to tell you just a little bit more film history to fill this back in, the place of these little tiny movie theaters, as I said, they grew and grew. So they said up to 20 to 25,000 of them in the 1920s, even as those big picture palaces grew. There were lots and lots of movie theaters. Two things happened in the sort of late 1920s that would greatly disrupt that pattern that had gone on. One was the coming of talking, sound motion pictures. Al Jolson and the Jazz Singer, all those, that new technology of sound motion pictures was revolutionary. In America, it was the talkies, the new sound motion pictures, were so popular with audiences that movie attendance went up by 40 million. So, I mean, that's virtually 40%. So, these new talkies were so popular that more and more people started going to the movies. And it was really great, and they really loved them. And movie theaters, especially these picture palaces, were earning money hand over fist. Very popular films, very exciting. Everybody starts going to the movies. Well, the downside of that sound movie revolution was it cost a whole lot of money to renovate a silent movie theater into a talkie movie theater. You had to purchase, the equipment was very expensive. Sound projectors, speakers, equipment, ways of making the acoustics, the hearing better in these theaters. Well, the biggest movie theaters had the backing, they had funds, they had the backing of the movie studios, and they could get money, they said, and they were getting great big attendance. So it was, these big picture palaces were the splashy ones who renovated their theaters earliest to show these new talkie movies. And so these big theaters are reaping all the benefits of the new technology, the increased audience. Yay, everything is great. On the other hand, that same revolution was really, really difficult for these motion picture theaters, these smaller, older individual theaters. To them, the talkies were a disaster. It was a terrible thing. It's a little like now, something similar happening now is this move to major motion pictures are now all provided digitally. They're not provided on 35 millimeter film anymore. And so small theaters around the world today are facing the same problem of a changing technology that's very expensive to install, and so is meaning that many smaller, older theaters are having to close if they can't afford all the money to install the new technology. You might have to shut down. This is happening a lot in the United States with small community theaters, senior citizen centers or in schools or in things like that. In rural communities, there are a lot of theaters that had still been showing films for their communities are facing having to close down because they can't afford this new technology. That's just what happened to these smaller, older theaters. It really meant a great difference between the big picture palace now that was not only elegant, but it had the new technology. People very much wanted to go there. It made these smaller, older theaters seem that much more backward and old and So they said the spending the money was very, very difficult for them. Some were able up to okay. Let me add to that. As I said, it's a 1-2 punch. So not only did these smaller, older theaters not have necessarily the money to be able to invest in all this new equipment, but the second thing that happened in the U.S. just at this time was the stock market crash, the start of our Great Depression in America that eventually meant depression worldwide throughout the 1930s. The coming of the Great Depression in 1939 meant that average workers, we had up to 50% unemployment. The Great Depression, it was terrible in the U.S. So many people unemployed, and if you're unemployed, you don't have the money and you can't go to the movies. So you can't borrow money. So I want you to think that hard times, as well as all the money it would have cost to put in that new equipment, meant that these smaller, older theaters shut down by the thousands. So we lost something in some parts of the country. As many as 40% of all the movie theaters closed because they were these older, smaller theaters that couldn't afford the new technology. And then their audiences were disappearing because of hard times. It's interesting that didn't happen. Again, the film historians who didn't want to look at individual case studies didn't understand. That's why I needed to tell this story to them. To say, here come the late 1920s, the 1930s. There are tremendous differences in the access of Americans to their movie theaters. Because the places where 40% of the theaters closed were not in New York City. New York City and Chicago, the largest urban areas that had the biggest populations, those theaters could manage to squeak by. So big city movie theaters were not as affected by this. As I said, they could get bank loans, they could make the technology, and they managed to do fairly well during the hard times of the Depression. The theaters that were hit the most hard were all these rural theaters across the American South, across the American Midwest, and in the far West here. Up to 40% of all those theaters closed. And all those people didn't have access to the movies for a long time. So, again, I want you to think it's a crisis. Well, to bring that back to my trade paper, as I said, back to the growth of the Hollywood film industry. Remember when I had said that the studios out in California had tried to control the whole country by owning the biggest theaters and then by saying if you want one of our movies, you must buy all 52, must rent all 52 of them. This was especially hard for those little theaters. So not only, as I said, if you could afford to put in the sound equipment, if you could afford to keep your theater open even when all your the patrons are losing their jobs and have very little money. On top of this, you've got the problem of you have to take all these films that Hollywood is shoving out. You have you don't seem to have much choice of films. You've got to show, because you signed the contract with what the studios send you. Well, like I said, this had been a frustrating problem for small town theater managers. And they had asked, led by that one guy named J.C. Jenkins, in the 1920s, the small town theater managers had kind of banded together and asked to have one column in the biggest trade paper where they could talk to each other, where they could say, if we have to show these Hollywood movies, could we not write our own movie reviews in and tell each other of the movies that are out there, which ones did the best with our particular small town audiences? So that if you have to show, if you're your choices are so bound, and you have to show all these films, how could you make the best choices? How could you avoid the ones, if you could, to avoid a film in this contract, you could play it for maybe only one day instead of five. You could substitute another film or an older film for one film that you don't want to show. So there were a few parameters that these small town theaters could do to try and manage their theater to please their individual audiences. So, as I said, they were able to start this little review column in the trade journal. And it started out as one page, and it eventually grew to five. And it made a really interesting source, for me to read. And they said, to try and understand, as I said, how, if you were a small town movie theater manager, how are you going to survive these hard times? How are you going to please your audience? And reading, these things are all just little reviews of individual films. But people would not only talk about the films, but they would add in extra comments about what's going on in their town or what did their audiences think. And so I went through a long project. This was published weekly, and I read 10 years of every week of this column. Wore my eyes out. But it was, as I said, it was a really interesting research project to try and get into the minds of all these theater managers of what's going on. So, as I said, I'd found this column, and a few other historians, film historians, had plucked out the occasional movie review when they were writing a film history about, say, the Marx Brothers of the 1930s, or musicals of the 1930s, or American gangster films of the 1930s. Other film historians would pluck out one of these quotes and say, here's what Americans thought of that film. Well, I'm taking them to task a little bit, because the more you know about this particular column, the more you understand this is not the point of view of the manager of this picture palace, not at all. It's the point of view of the manager of these little tiny movie theaters. And it comes in handy because, as they said, they pull the quotes out of context. So, they said, during the boom of talkies in 1929, when the picture palaces were doing so well, the trade journal got so fed up with this, and they said, we don't really want to hear small theaters' problems anymore. They eliminated the column. They said, we don't need you anymore. We're making so much money in our picture palaces that your worries. We don't have to hear about them. We don't care about them. Well, then the Depression struck and got worse and worse. As I said, with unemployment across the U.S. at up to 50%, movie theaters going bankrupt everywhere, the movie theater business said, uh-oh, we need the help of everyone we can get. So let's reinstitute this column. Let's bring it back. They brought it back in January 1933. Okay, small town movie theater managers, we do need your advice. You do need to talk to each other. We'll bend in. We'll give in. We'll start talking to you again. So, as I said, I was able to look at it from 1933 on to 1940. It was curious, again, in reading all of these, burning my eyes out, reading all of these little reports, to find out, I did a whole lot of work with my map, and I charted where every person who wrote into the column was. And it turned out in that column, they were never from New York City. They were never from Chicago. They were all these folks from, indeed, the Midwest. Little tiny theaters in little tiny towns in like North Dakota and South Dakota. Little farmers. Villages and things like that. So I was able to confirm that the people who wrote into that one particular column were not the people who ran a picture palace. It was all these little tiny managers of little towns in the South and in the Midwest, and sometimes up in northern New England, which had some small villages way up north of New York, but not, as I said, not large cities at all. What I also learned, it was interesting, by reading, by then going back and doing, searching through city directories, trying to find out more about the people who wrote into this column the most, it turned out that there were about 50 people who wrote in the most often, and it took a lot of time. So each individual had to fill out a slip of paper saying, here's the movie I showed, here, it stunk. It terrible, or it was great. And they would have to write this in for each movie they showed and send it in to the trade journal. So it took a fair amount of effort in the days before the internet and the computer to be able to contribute. But about, as I said, about 50 people did it regularly, like every week. And so reading all their comments year after year after year, I found some interesting commonalities and some interesting stories from them. Well, one of the stories I found the most interesting was what they thought their audiences want. Now, if you've probably, hopefully you've seen a fair amount of American films in the 1930s or what you've read about Hollywood history, you may think of it as the era of the Marx Brothers, of glamorous movie stars like Joan Crawford, of sexy stars like Mae West, of, you know, that's, you might think of cowboys like John Wayne, handsome actors, beautiful actresses. If that's what Hollywood was producing, what these individuals in the small-town movie theaters wanted was something actually very different. What they said their audiences wanted were what I consider unlikely movie stars. For small-town audiences, their favorite movie stars were old people. Not glamorous glamour pusses, but they said an old woman named Marie Dressler, who made quite a number of comedies. She ended up dying about 1935, very early. But her films, where she plays a garrulous, a very funny old woman, very down to earth, very natural. Films like Min and Bill. She worked at MGM. She was one of their number one stars. So they didn't want a glamorous, beautiful movie star. They wanted someone who looked very realistic, very sort of country-like, very down home. Their most favorite male star was a fellow named Will Rogers. Will Rogers was from Oklahoma. He was a cowboy. He's half Cherokee Indian. Will Rogers was not only a great trick roper, but he was also one of the funniest political commentators in the country. He had been in New York City and in Flo Ziegfeld's elaborate show that the most wealthy people in New York went to Broadway to see him. He would come out in a cowboy outfit telling jokes about politics and the president and the government and what's going on in popular culture. So he was wry. He was very much a country fella, very much a sort of cowboy. He was very smart, but very much a sort of down-home, very old-fashioned, down-home, smart, but very unpretentious kind of comedy. He was so that's the number one female star and the number one male star. He's not handsome. He is not elegant. He also died in 1935. Whoops. Their third biggest star, there's four, the third biggest star for them was little Shirley Temple. Tiny little baby Shirley Temple with her 54 golden curls, her sweet angelic face, her singing on the good ship Lollipop. She was a special favorite. She was a favorite all across the country, but especially in small town America. She's so tiny, she's so adorable and cute, she's like cat videos. But she was incredibly talented, and it's very interesting. To them, to small town audiences, she represented something like an angel. She represented something so perfect, so adorable, so cute, that the whole country just, you know, wanted to just hug her. And it's very interesting that her films would be so popular during such hard economic times. And scholars have said about Shirley Temple, you know, okay, so she's not glamorous, although they would shoot those 54 curls to make her look rather pretty. But in a way, she represented, in very dark times, she represented hope. She represented something. She would always be the only child in the film, and she would usually, there'd be no mother, and she'd be among these grumpy old men. And through her brightness and charm and dancing, she would warm the hearts of grumpy old men and bring them love. Shirley Temple was not about money. She was about radiating love and adorableness. And some film scholars have said she was especially a big star in the 1930s for bringing that sense of hope, that sense of beauty and love in just such a little adorable package. So they said, especially to small town theater, she was a huge star. The other was, their one glamorous actress was a woman named Janet Gaynor. You may have seen her in the original A Star Is Born. But otherwise, she is the most sort of down-home girl next door. She's not glamorous. She's not ice queen beautiful. She's just a sort of, and she's very sweet. She's very funny. She's, as I said, she's not overly sexual. So I want you to think this sort of unlikely quartet of stars. This is what the small town theater manager said their patrons wanted to see, these four and anybody in a cowboy hat. They loved westerns. Ooh. Now, none of these movies were popular at all. None of these stars were popular at all at the picture palaces. So the interesting thing I found during this research project was that basically you can think there were two different Americas. When it came to Hollywood is producing this product, and they only wanted to, the Hollywood producers wanted to say all of America, like all of these stars equally. But what I found through my research was there was at least two different audiences. The Picture Palace audience loved Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and Clark Gable and Errol Flynn and, you know, Gary Cooper. The Picture Palace audience wanted elegant costume dramas and big swashbuckling things. And the kind of films are Katharine Hepburn films. So screwball comedies, elegant dramas. Those were the kinds of films that did very well for this audience. But the audience for these theaters wanted a different kind of film. They wanted Laurel and Hardy. They wanted sweet little Shirley Temple. They wanted very comfortable, homey, country-looking people who spoke more closely to them. So, as I said, that was one of the most interesting things I learned about the differences between these two audiences. Another thing I learned that if you all ever are involved in doing local history projects, another thing I learned from the column was that if you were running one of these theaters in a small town, the least of your problems was a bad movie. I learned that there were so many more problems of just getting people to come to your theater that that these urban picture palace theaters never had to worry about. If you managed this theater, you were in the middle of a large city. Your people could get to you by subway, by walking, by trains and buses. There were so many ways. You're in the middle of the city. There were so many ways for people to get to you. If you had one of these little theaters out in the middle of nowhere, you might be showing the world's greatest movie. You might be showing a Shirley Temple film. But in small towns, the exhibitors had to worry so much more about the weather. If it was snowing a blizzard, you could be showing the best movie and no one would come to see it because they literally couldn't get to your theater. Heavy rainstorms, hurricanes, the Dust Bowl. It is too hot. It's too cold. So the stories of these small theater managers remind me of there are so many factors other than the movie on the screen that could play into the health of this theater or how are they doing. In a small town, it mattered a whole lot of if something else was going on. If it was high school commencement, if it was if there was a football match, everyone would go to the football game and not come to the movie theater. If there was a parade, if there was a church holiday or something like that. So these these managers had to work around many other problems or situations in their communities that didn't bother the people in the picture palaces. They hated these guys. They said the pictures they hated were it's so interesting. And they would label any picture they didn't, that when these folks wrote into that column, they would label any picture they didn't like as a urban picture, a big city picture, and all big city pictures are bad. And it was interesting to see them enumerate what kind of pictures their audiences didn't like. So they said they didn't, they claim their audiences didn't like sexually provocative pictures. So no Mae West, no none of these pictures, a Greta Garbo picture where she's a prostitute, none of those, because small towns tended to be very conservative. And if the church ladies are out front picketing your movie theater, you're a local movie theater, a small movie theater was much more beholden to its individual community, and you must sort of please the individual community. So they would say that Hollywood sort of pre-code sexual pictures caused them any number of grief. They said, oh, this one's terrible. I'm going to get censored. I'm going to get run out of town. Don't play this picture. They said, on the other hand, they worried that urban sophisticated comedies, things with fellas in, you know, dress suits, that's terrible. They claimed that their rural audiences didn't understand New York comics and ethnicity different from theirs, or things of the big city, things involving skyscrapers and martinis and things like that. So these movie theater managers claim that their audiences just didn't understand those and didn't like them. They also worried they didn't like big historical costume pictures. French Revolution, no. That's anybody, a man in a wig, no, doing a Revolutionary War picture. So, again, while Hollywood produced a number of historical epics during the 1930s, those didn't go over very well. They didn't like high culture. There were a number of movies in the 1930s featuring opera singers, including one a great story, one movie with an opera singer named Grace Moore. And the movie theater manager wrote into this column that when the actress opened her mouth to sing, somebody in the audience said, throw a fish in her mouth, like she was a seal or a whale or something. Like, throw a fish in her mouth. So sex is out, costume dramas are out, high culture is out. This is terrible. They also didn't like gangster movies or extra violence. They said, oh no, that's something only people in the cities would want to see, gangsters killing each other and all this. So they didn't like violence. That limits, if you think of what you know of Hollywood movies of the 30s, we're kind of limiting it more and more and more to just a few genres. What interesting factors, how these little local movie theaters managed to, how they wanted to attract their patrons. At the Picture Palace, again, back at the Picture Palace, in the large urban center, movie theater managers placed large advertisements in the newspaper. So you knew, you as a big city moviegoer would look through the newspaper and say, aha, this new film is playing here, or I always go to this particular fancy theater every week. So you advertise, if you are managing this theater, you advertise through elaborate ads in the newspaper. You might put up a beautiful big billboard near the theater or around town. There was, as I said, it was a lots of public but in big kind of displays ways of getting your advertising or your movie out. If you're on the other hand running this theater, your audience may live 30 miles away on a farm and they don't get the newspaper. Your newspaper may only come out once a week. It's not going to help you. So these little local movie theaters couldn't do the same kind of advertising that a picture palace could. There would not be big billboards, and you couldn't afford to put the posters up there anyway. It's very interesting that in small towns, a lot of the advertising was actually done in front of the theater. Here was the importance of the individual movie poster. These movie theater managers relied an awful lot on those kind of specific physical things. So they would put the poster out in front of the theater and hope that their trade would be the people who walked to and from their, you know, to do their shopping and go home, or walk from work to go home. So they depended a lot on foot traffic. And literally making their decision, if a town had two movie theaters, you would look at the posters at this one and look at the posters at that one to make your choice as to who to go in. So these people wrote into that trade journal a lot saying, give us posters that that faithfully depict what's going on the screen. Don't make the poster too violent. Don't make the poster too sexually obvious. Don't have body parts hanging out, things like that. So they wanted truthful posters. So as I said, individual things like posters meant a lot. Not maybe, and the names of stars, if it was a favorite star, if it was Shirley Temple, you needed to have Shirley Temple's name on the poster. But curiously, other things like the title of the film mattered a lot. And silly things, as I said, they want, in small towns, they said, please, could it have the name farm in it? Could it have the name small town in it? Could it not have the name like gangster or gun in it? They said, can you be truthful? Title. There was one film relatively famous in Hollywood history, a Broadway play called The Petrified Forest. And The Petrified Forest is actually out in Arizona, and it is rocks that had been trees that were turned into fossils. Fossilized trees, so ancient trees that had hardened into rocks. That's The Petrified Forest. But the movie was a drama set in Arizona, and it's very famous. It's an early Humphrey Bogart film. It's a drama that had been on Broadway with Betty Davis, and Humphrey Bogart comes in as a desperate killer, and he holds some people hostage. And so the managers wrote into that trade journal going, what a terrible title. Petrified Forest doesn't say what the film is about. Why can't you have called it Arizona Badman, Arizona Murderer, Arizona Gangster? That would have helped. So as they said, down to the very, they need titles to be appropriately descriptive to get their audiences who are walking by to understand what's going on. So I've talked about problems that the theaters faced. I've talked about what they want. But their weather problems, killed off in 1943, titles that the audience relate to, westerns, plain old characters, pull them in by titles and posters, sex, gangsters, and violence. Ah, another problem, another biggest difference between these audiences and the Picture Palace. Now, Picture Palace cost a fair amount of money to get into, 50 cents or a dollar, whereas my little local theater might be 10 cents. So this Picture Palace is 10 times more expensive to get into than the little theater. It tended to be mostly adult couples and middle class or fairly wealthy people to go to this place. Although they were democratic, and you could, if you, anybody who had a dollar could get into these places. A dollar was a lot of money back in the day. And so, as I said, the audience at these elegant theaters tended to be adults, tended to be older, relatively sophisticated couples. It's not necessarily families, and it's not necessarily children. Maybe only children on Saturday mornings. But so it's very much an adult, sophisticated audience. Because you had the entire city to draw from. And every big city also had small theaters in the neighborhoods. That's where the children would go to the movies. That's where the mothers would go to the movies with their babies in their arms. But to draw to the Picture Palaces, you went on an elegant date. You want, you know, so a very sophisticated adult audience. The small town theaters in small communities didn't have that luxury. The way they saw their audience, if your theater is in a town of only 2,000 people, you need as many of those 2,000 people to come to your theater every night as possible. You can't afford to only draw the men, to only draw the women, or to only draw the children. You need films that appeal to everybody and bring them all in together. This was not easy. So, as I said, I want you to think, you know, that's if you get any appreciation at all for how difficult it was to run one of these theaters when you had to please everyone in your community and not offend anyone so much that they'd stay home. So, again, these people write in over and over again that that certain films are not useful for them. They need to please everyone from age 3 to age 93 at the same time. And so, again, issues we usually don't think about when we're thinking about Hollywood film history and we're just looking at those individual plots. These managers write in and say things like, well, if it is a talky drama, the children will get bored and they will run around the theater and make noise, and this is bad. Or if it's something only for children, the adults will get bored and they won't like it. So, again, you think that it's rather difficult. It's not easy to make films that would please everyone in the audience. Today, are there films that please everyone in the audience? Maybe some of these comic book movies, maybe Iron Man. I like that it's a comic book, but I like his humor. It's got action. It's got Gwyneth Paltrow. If you think only certain movies today have something built in for many different kinds of audiences. Now we think, oh, I'm going to make an action film for young men to watch. I'm going to make a romantic comedy for women to watch and maybe people on dates. I'm going to make a children's animated movie. So today, we mostly make movies for very different audiences. But if you think that problem, these people needed one movie that would please everybody. They also had another problem that if anybody in the audience was angry, they would take it out on the movie theater manager. You can't now, if you didn't like the movie played at the Picture Palace, this Picture Palace had 2,000 seats. And you'd just be one of 2,000 people, and you maybe march out. You could shake a finger at an usher. What are you going to do? It's a great big audience, and you're not going to see the manager if the theater has 2,000 seats. Now, if you're on the other hand, if you're in a town that only has 2,000 people, and you go to the theater that only has 200 seats, and you don't like the movie, and you've lived in this town forever, and that manager is somebody who's been in that town forever, you're going to find that manager, and you're going to tell them in no uncertain terms that that was a terrible movie, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So, as I said, local managers had much more of a stake in their individual community of having, indeed, to please, oh dear, to compromise, to please their individual audiences, and they would write in to this column. And sometimes greatest compliment that they could give to a film, they would say, show this particular film. They would say, people came up and shook my hand. They said, this was a marvelous film. Or it was one, they would say, this is one I didn't have to run up and hide in the projection booth away from the angry patrons for. So as I said, I just want you to think about that some theaters, perhaps in local communities, had all these different levels of continuing connections to the audiences and to the films. As I said, at a big anonymous picture palace where you're one of just 2,000 people, that audiences kind of come and go, and it's such a big city and it's such urban anonymity we could just sort of think more theoretically or more generally about spectators and films. When we get down to, on the other hand, this kind of level of local movie theaters and local managers, as I said, I found through studying this one column, I found lots and lots of kinds of examples of all different kinds of local connections that could be made. Favorite stars in some regions, as I said, favorite kinds of movies, things that they especially didn't like. For favorite stars, I found that this was kind of interesting that, I could use my little star. Up here, the most Scandinavians, immigrants from Sweden and Norway, many of them settled up here in the northern plains in North and South Dakota. And of any place, the great star Greta Garbo was pretty much a bust. She played a hot, MGM loved her because she was very popular in Europe. And her films were very popular in large cities. But down in the South, they hated Greta Garbo. And the theater managers would always complain, don't make more Greta Garbo films, don't send them to us. Oh my goodness, it's so terrible, the audience hates them. But interestingly, even just the wheat farmers grizzled old wheat farmers up here in the Dakotas, where the population was much more heavily Scandinavian. They loved Greta Garbo as being a felt person from their country. So there, I found these kind of sort of odd, unusual things about, as I said, sometimes an individual star who had great popularity in one part of the country, but not in another. Okay, so I've got pictures they hate. They hate historical epics, they hate opera, they hate sex, they hate bad posters. They've got exhibitors are part of the community can look. Okay, so individual movie stars and these folks being part of their community. I'm going to get done. The good news is I've only got about 10 more minutes of this stuff. So, as I said, it was interesting to find out information, and I'd love to find out more about the individuals who ran these theaters because they were very much part of their own communities. I found that oftentimes if the community had a heavy ethnic or racial group in it, that they were largely going to be members of that, so that if it's in the Dakotas, the theater manager was most likely to be of a Swedish or Norwegian heritage. Now, interestingly, in the South, in the American South, remember where I said that's where the African Americans lived, and that's where racism was such a problem. Many theaters, if they didn't allow African Americans in at all, some Southern theaters were for whites only. And there were separate theaters for black folks to go to. And they would be little tiny theaters, and there were not very many different films for them to see. Black audiences in the American South also had to see regular Hollywood films. There's a very interesting story. What I learned from case studies of small black theaters in the South is that sometimes when a black actor had a very small role in a film, like even just a butler or a maid, or a mammy or something, that actor's name would be put up as the big star of the film because black audiences so longed in lily white Hollywood to see a representation of a character who anyway looked like themselves. So they were able to take these films and kind of read it against the grain. They were able to say, hooray, even though that actor's in a very small role, we'll pay a lot of attention to that part when it comes on the screen. And so indeed, the managers would even say Bill Robinson or Hattie McDaniel or something like that is actually the star of the film. They did that a lot. Louis Armstrong might be making one little musical appearance in the film, but suddenly it would be Louis Armstrong and not Bing Crosby as starring in this film. They would read against the grain. They would, they said they would take small parts and put them up like this. Black theaters, as I said, very much African Americans were very much second, third class citizens in the American South. They would only get the movies like 6 months after they had played in the white theaters. So it was very, everything was smaller than, kind of less than. There were a small number of films made for the black market. There were some black westerns with black cowboys on the range. That's pretty cool. Some small musical numbers with great musicians like Louis Armstrong or Cab Calloway. And I think of other great black musicians would be put into musical shorts, and sometimes those short features would be what people actually came to see, and the exhibitor would then show a regular Hollywood film, but the highlight of the program might not be the feature, but short films that featured African-American characters. It's really kind of interesting. I found, as I said, the only places that showed European films, there would be some small, the largest cities that had ethnic populations, there were some German theaters in New York City and Chicago. There were some Jewish theaters that would play Yiddish film and Jewish film in New York. But otherwise, not so much. That Hollywood system kept things kind of to a minimum. All right. One other thing that's really curious is that these smaller theaters also allowed for a wider variety of people to manage them. And I found up to about 10 to 15% of all these small theaters were managed by women. A few even owned by women. Kind of that's nice, hooray. But it was interesting that the women who owned theaters and who wrote into the column were oftentimes much more educated. They had college educations. And they thought of their theaters, they would write in about being proud to show theaters that were movies that were based on literature that might either educate or connect to their audiences in different ways. They wanted to enlighten and educate their audiences as well as please them. The female managers would often would also write more often about wanting to please their female patrons or to please the children. So the female managers oftentimes talked more about the movie theater as kind of being a home place. Sort of like a home away from home or that kind of a community space. So, as I said, they would voice those ideas about the local theater being an extension of the home or being having a lot more local connections sometimes than the men would. I also wanted to mention that those African American, the theaters for blacks across the South, their managers would nevertheless, for the most part, still be white. It was so difficult for African Americans to have a business. It was very, very hard. Local custom as well as even laws in the South would do everything to make it so difficult for blacks to have any kind to earn any kind of decent incomes to get jobs. But so even their theaters were oftentimes managed by white men. But in the best of those managers, they said, would do things to reach out to the black community for their theaters. Another thing they would do is if all the movies were white, maybe they'd have a local performer on stage before the movie, somebody singing or performing or things like that. These local theaters, also much more than the picture palaces just run for movies, but these local theaters sometimes found themselves, if a church congregation, if there was a fire in a church and the church could no longer meet, the movie theater, a local movie theater might do something like volunteer that on Sunday mornings the congregation could meet in the theater. Things like high school graduation ceremonies were sometimes in a small town, the movie theater was one of the only sort of gathering places. So, as I said, those kind of community events might be there. The movie theater manager, like other local merchants, might also contribute to local events. Hold parades, donate money to various events. So I want you to think that these local theaters had to work much harder to be approved of community centers, whereas the Picture Palace could just sort of stand apart as I'm just a big urban center kind of spectacular place to go to watch movies. No, in smaller towns, the managers had to make much more concrete connections to their audiences. I found as the decade of the 30s sort of wore down or ended up, movie theaters were facing increasing number of problems. Hollywood in the late 30s started making a few more spectacular individual films that they started charging more money for at the box office. They said instead of charging, they would make the rental rates much higher. And small town theaters found that really difficult to deal with. They said, we can't afford now. You're putting out movies that we can't afford to play. What's going to happen to us? Well, it turned out, amusingly to me, that they one of the sort of greatest Hollywood movies of all time, one of the most famous Hollywood films, Gone with the Wind, turned out to be a particularly disastrous experience for small-town theaters across the country. Gone with the Wind, if anything, was meant to be shown in picture palaces. It was 50% longer than any Hollywood movie at 3.5 hours long. It was huge. You could only afford to show it twice a day instead of the little 60 and 75-minute movies. Gone with the Wind was presented as a spectacular event. Da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. If you think for small town movie theaters, it's everything that they are against. It is a historical costume drama. It involves sort of love and sex. It involves violence of the American Civil War. And so it made many small town movie theaters feel very inadequate. They said, oh, it's too big a movie to play in our theaters. Hollywood also did them extra dirt. Hollywood treated small town movie theaters especially badly with this film, because when the film came out, they said, we demand that you charge double or triple the usual fee, ticket charge, to go into this movie. This movie is so special, you must charge three times the amount of regular ticket prices to go into that. They also, kind of in the entire first year that the film was out, it was so popular in America that for an entire year, it was mostly only booked into large urban picture palaces. But it was a movie that had come from the book, had come out 2 to 3 years before, and the book was so popular, everybody in America, lots and lots of people in America were so anxious to see this film, that if you lived in a small town, you might drive 100 miles and spend the night to go see this film in a large city. So this film drew, even at three times the ticket price, it was such an event that it drew everyone to the picture palaces. And it's still, adjusting for inflation, it is still the highest grossing motion picture of all times. So, and a lot of that money was spent when it first came out. So people by the droves came from their small towns, went to the large city in that first year, paid the enormous ticket price to see Gone with the Wind. By the time it was available to be shown in small town theaters, the problem was they still demanded that you charge the second year. They still demanded that you charge three times the regular admission price to go this. When small town theaters like this tried to play Gone with the Wind, as I said, it was a complete disaster. Forced to charge so much to go see the movie, their only audiences who could afford to see the movie had already gone to see the movie. That's the wealthiest people in these small towns had saved up their money, had taken their cars, had driven to the big city, had seen it. They didn't need to see it again anytime soon. So over and over again, I found in the articles in this What the Picture Did for Me column, these small town exhibitors would write in that they showed the greatest motion picture of all time to empty theaters. Absolutely. So it was a disaster. So as they said, they were forced to charge so much to see it that most of their audiences couldn't afford to go. The movie featured everything that they had said was not what that the rest of their audiences wanted to see. As I said, it's not a Western. It doesn't have Shirley Temple in it. It's not a little old happy person like Marie Dressler. So they said, absolutely unmitigated disaster. And I find that very amusing because it kind of throws my regular Hollywood history on its head. But by the 1940s, these movie theater managers are still hanging in there, but it's kind of their days are going to be numbered. What they write in right before World War II begins, they write into the trade journal with their sort of wish list of, please, Hollywood, don't forget us. They say, still, we want Westerns. They said, we still want pictures from, get this, they actually write in, they say, we still want pictures starring Will Rogers and Marie Dressler and Shirley Temple. This was a problem. Will Rogers had been dead for 5 years. Marie Dressler, dead for 5 years. Shirley Temple is now 16, a mother. She's grown great big breasts. And she no longer looks like that adorable. Even her hair isn't blonde anymore. So Shirley Temple grew up, and the other two major stars died. And the small town theaters were not finding anyone, other stars coming up in the Hollywood ranks to replace them. So it looks to me, what they are saying is that Hollywood has again sort of abandoned them. That the Hollywood is ghostly going for pictures that would play for urban audiences. And they're not playing particularly for small-town audiences. The Second World War in America would have tremendous impact on small towns. We were so incredibly fortunate that the war was not fought on American shores, destroying Europe, but not in America. But nevertheless, World War II completely upended American society. Suddenly, from so much unemployment, there is total employment. And in fact, more people had to go to work. So suddenly, American factories had to produce all the guns and bombs and planes and tanks and all that to go fight the Second World War. So very interestingly, all the American factories stopped making what they had been making. No more automobiles, no more refrigerators or toasters or anything else. All those factories started making, as I said, planes and tanks and guns and bombs. And they put all of Americans to work, including women staying at home and children, mostly women staying at home, even African Americans. Even the tremendous racism against African Americans was lifted for a little while during the Second World War. But they said the factories making all these goods were across the upper Midwest. They were in Ohio. They were in Michigan. They were in Illinois. And what happened during World War II was a tremendous movement of people out of the South and out of the rural Midwest. As they suddenly, there are great big jobs. They are needed in American factories, but there are jobs there. So for all the poor African Americans, poor African American farmers during World War II, they're able to move to Chicago and or move to Detroit or move to Pittsburgh and get good paying jobs in factories. It's marvelous thing for them, but there's a tremendous movement of people. So poor people leave the South, farmers leave the Midwest, and something like 20 million Americans are in the military. So I want you to think, lots of people moving away. It hit American small towns the hardest between all the people away in the military, all the people away in the army, and all the young people moving away or whole families moving away for wartime jobs. This was incredibly hard on small town movie theaters. One of the prominent writers into my column, one of the women who ran a movie theater, had been in a town in western Kansas, very rural to begin with, up here right in the middle, far end of Kansas there above Texas by two. And while in the 1930s her town had 1,000 people, during the war that was reduced to 200 people. So many people were gone either for the jobs or into the military that she had to shut the theater. There was no one left to go to the movie theater. So that happened a lot in small towns, that things that temporarily people were gone. But after World War II, more changes happened to American culture. People who came back from the war or who went to those factory jobs didn't move back to the South or move back to small towns. American population became much more urban oriented, and that's where our suburbs come from. There wasn't enough housing in the old cities for them, so there's a tremendous building for the returning soldiers, lovely little individual houses with white picket fences on little neighborhoods. So there was a tremendous shift in population toward larger cities and away from small towns. If that's the one punch, the other punch that happened for these small town theaters was the coming of television. With the coming of suddenly, from 1900 to 1945, that's nearly 50 years of being the only entertainment in town, regular entertainment in town. Now, with the quick spread of television, American families had entertainment in their living rooms, in their homes. You don't have to go out anymore. And that was decimating for American movie theaters. American movie attendance as a whole plummeted by 75% over that period from the late 1940s to about 1960. So during all that era of beautiful film noir films and things like, all those other interesting Hollywood movies, fewer and fewer and fewer Americans were going to the movies. And the theaters, again, hit the hardest would be these little small town ones. So I said, these little theaters definitely had a history of a sort of a founding and a kind of rise. They faced a number of challenges, but then after World War II, they basically, it's kind of like the movie The Last Picture Show. They mostly the small cinemas most all go out of business. With 75% of the audience gone, the coming of the second Hollywood, the new wave in the 1970s, mean that a whole new generation of movie theaters are being built. Both the little old picture theaters have shuttered, but also the old picture palaces have closed because they're getting old. They kind of smell. They're not. They were not built. They were built to be beautiful, but not built out of marble. They are not built out of fabrics to last. This is all plaster of Paris and cardboard. So these theaters too, and that population shift out to these new suburbs. No one would go to the small town theaters, but no one would come to these theaters anymore. And so what happened in America during about the 1960s would be the starting of building a whole new generation of theaters out near our new suburban shopping malls. And now we have yet another new generation. We have, I bet you all have multiplexes, 6, 8, 10 screens. We've got some in America that have 27 screens in one complex. I think there are not enough movies to show on 27 screens. I don't know what they're playing, but that's, I can't think of 27 movies that I'd want to see. So I want you to think that sort of what I've learned is that while it's I truly believe and think it's very interesting to preserve as historical monuments or as historic theaters, sort of the old picture palaces or these old theaters. But nevertheless, if you look over a century, there's a kind of these theaters all kind of have a history, and they have a kind of rise and a fall as they respond to the sort of changing ways that Americans want to see movies or the changing places where Americans live. And so they said, I learned that it's not just sort of one American audience over time, but one with a lot more complexities of individual case studies that make the story kind of more interesting for me. How did we do on time? That's all right. I at least got till 20 till. So, but that still leaves me time for sort of any kind of questions. Does anybody hear it now? As I said, that this whole idea of the importance of a movie theater is kind of very challenged today by the fact that most all my undergraduates want to watch films on their computer screens. They don't want to go to movie theaters anymore. In fact, but curiously, the only place that they will go to gather is at a Starbucks, at a coffee shop. So America is now covered, like with McDonald's on the one hand and Starbucks on the other. It's just littered with them. And so I think it's kind of interesting in modern American society, the one place where we kind of have to gather in small communities are the rise of coffee shops. Some scholars call them third places. You've got home, you've got work, and you've got the coffee shop. It's kind of like, did you have the TV comedy Friends? Yes, you know, they have the coffee shop. They got the apartment. I don't think they work, but they have the coffee, you know, the coffee shop. Well, I said, so it's kind of, so on the one hand, I'm very glad to see that kind of thing, the coffee shop arise, although I can never get a seat in one because there's somebody always working on something and the place is full. But sadly, as I said, it's not oftentimes the movie theater. Although where I live in Austin, Texas, we're bucking the trend. We have a chain of movie theaters that everyone locally wants to go to. It's called the Alamo, after our famous Texas landmark. But what they do is, now, it's a chain of movie theaters. One, they serve, it's a really wonderful restaurant. They have a row of tables in front of every seat. And a waitress come by, and they have really good hamburgers and really great beer and pizzas and things like that. So you can, so it's really good food, not just stale popcorn to eat when you're at the movie. And if they take care to have a really great projection experience, meaning very comfortable chairs, and you never have to look over somebody's head, and the projection is always just the right shape. So, as I said, they make it especially comfortable and nice. They charge twice the amount of that it would cost to go to any other movie theater. But they also, the people who run the movie theater, do a marvelous job of, for every film, they add in all kinds of little extras. The people who run the theater will make a special trailers or films to show before the film that that make fun of the film. When Guardians of the Galaxy... When that film was out this summer, I saw it at the Alamo, and they had found all manner of little nature films with raccoons and other animals, and then they had movies with trees in it. And so they did all, and these things were put together to be sort of clever and funny. So at the Alamo, you want to go to the movie 45 minutes ahead of time to see all the things they've created to go with the movie, to help it. It's very interesting. They are very strict about at this theater about you cannot talk during the movie. If you talk, they will grab you and throw you out of the theater. They're fascist about it, really. So they do that, but they run other screenings where they want you to talk to the film. They will show the dialogue down here, and they want you to sing with the Sound of Music. They want you to, you know, to quote all the lyrics to a Monty Python film. So this one theater chain takes a special. Is maybe bringing back this idea of the local community theater and involving us and making it a place you want to go with your friends, as expensive as it may be, but you want to keep going back because they're involving you a lot. And maybe that's one of the few ways that a local movie theater might stay in business. But I'll be curious if you think about, do you know of any theaters where either because that it's such a part of the community that everybody always goes there, or a theater that actually goes out of its way to bring in and present films in a way that makes you feel like you have a connection to it. I want you to think about those. So, I've talked for a long time, but questions or comments or concerns? Is there a screening series here? I understand you all have a movie theater here on campus. I understand you, yes. Does anyone here involved in the programming of it? That would be nice, no? So I would think that fine. I got to do that when I was a student, and I only showed films that I want to see. It was not very good for our budget, but I had a great time. Empty theater, me watching, having a very good time, so. Okay, well, I got till quarter till. I thought that's... Sure, well, I'll give you a preview of, I'll leave with a brief preview of how this is going to go on as I continue to talk and talk and talk tomorrow. What I'll be doing the rest of the week is continuing, as I said, my goal here is to keep showing you all, the usefulness or the interesting aspects of studying these local aspects, whether it's a local theater or, as I said, or sort of local historical ingredients, a local historical context that have made movie going an interesting part of American culture. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about another thing that happened during the terrible times in the 1930s, and it's a story about a small movie theaters like this, desperate to fill their empty theater, and the ways they reached out to audience members, especially to women, by giving away things for free. And so they gave away free dishes, and I will bring some pictures of the very inexpensive dishware they brought. But it's a very interesting relationship between male movie theater managers and the women of the audience during the hard times of the 1930s, as women longed for beautiful things to have in their home, but also practical things to have in their home, and how the giving away of things like glasses and dishes became more important than any movie they were showing on the screen. So I'm going to talk about that case study of some stuff I'd found. And also tomorrow, I'm going to talk about some case studies of the first generation of young people to grow up with the movies. So as I said, if I'm asking you, can you remember the earliest movies you saw when you were very young? Maybe you watched Walt Disney movies. Walt Disney movies over and over again on a DVR in your parents' house. But if you think about what movies can you remember, what experiences from when you were a very small child to growing up to where you are now? That was the assignment given to some students, university students in 1929. And I'm going to be talking to you about what kind of answers they came up with. And sort of how we could put together their stories as in kind of a sort of sociological, psychological pattern of ways in which young people become interested in the stories of the films, and as well as the practice of going to their local movie theater. Then after two more talks about movies, I'm going to switch a little bit to some other research I've been doing that still involves for Americans. Media in everyday life, especially during those hard times in the 1930s. I'm going to switch from film to radio broadcasting. In America, first the people who brought us television first developed everything in commercial radio. The same kind of programs, comedies, westerns, musical shows, variety, news, cooking programs, all the things that we've grown used to on television, the American radio networks were not controlled by the state. No state involvement at all. They were all commercial. And I'm going to be talking about the ways that their programming also influenced everyday life. So the same people who were going to these movie theaters also at home turned on the radio. And I happen to be working on a project about the greatest comedian in American radio. And I've got two subjects to talk about. One is about him and the ways in which he involved the ideas of motion picture and film culture in his radio broadcast, because radio and film were very rival media that hated each other and were constantly fighting for those same audiences. But I'm also really intrigued by the way this comedian involved advertising and consumer products so completely in his comedy that it was much, he was, the products he was advertising were as much a part of his show and his personality in a way that we haven't been able to do since, but I would think more and more in new media, current media, especially on things being broadcast on the computer, we might have this happening again, this close connection between performer and consumer product. So I'll bring a can of Coca-Cola maybe tomorrow, because I usually use the evil Coca-Cola as my my consumer product. And then finally, I will also talk about that comedian brought an African-American, brought a black performer onto his show and made him the number one black performer in all of American media in ways that involve both radio and film. So I will get a chance to talk a bit more about the history of race and race relations and black culture in America. And that's what we'll be doing the rest of this week. So that's what I've got. I welcome your comments. Come on up and talk to me. And otherwise, I look forward to seeing you all tomorrow. Do we have final announcements or anything? So.
Then
that's great. But I look forward to meeting you. Thanks.